And welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm Anne Gordon here with my friend and Chavruta Yardena Osband. Our daf of the day, Masachet Bava Kama, daf Kuf Yud Aleph, page 111. We're coming to the end of the parak. We're about to start a new parak. I'm going to take the end. Yardena, you'll take the beginning. We have here the Gemara on the Mishnah. I wanted to talk more about these priestly watches that have the names given. Natana da Kesef Laho Yariv, right? So we understand that this means the family of Yehoyariv, that this is the priestly family of Yehoyariv, where the robber gives the money to that particular watch, and they give the guilt offering, and this is the issue, right, to the next watch, which is Yedaya. And the question is, you know, how does that work if you've got two different families of the Kohanim doing the jobs? You know, is that allowed? Is that not allowed? How does it pan out? Some of this already came up in the Mishnah. I want to note that Rashi explains that the reason that Yehoyariv and Yedaya are the ones who are named here is that it turns out that if you go look at the list of the priestly watches in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles, these are the first two. Meaning, it's an example. It's not specific. It's not, you know, we saw a lot about other specific priestly families that knew, these are the people who knew how to make the lechem apanim, the shoebread for the Beit HaMikdash. And these are the people who had the expertise in the weaving. And those were specific to those families. These are an example of a Kohanim family. It's not as specific as it sounds. And it sounds so specific, which, so at the very least, that Rashi suggests that it's not as particular as all that. All right, so the Gemara here picks up on all of this. Tana Rabbanan, Natan Asham li Yehoyariv, v'chesef li Yedaya, Yachzir kesef etzel Asham, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. The Chachamim omrim yachzir Asham etzel kesef. We have a dispute here between Rabbi Yehuda and the rabbis, the majority view. What's the case? The citation here is from a Tosefta, the Tosefta chapter 10, meaning in Bava Kama, if I'm not mistaken, but I think it is, right? That the robber, if the robber gives the Asham, right, the guilt offering, to be offered by the Yehoyariv family, and then gives the money to the Yedaya family, the claim here is that they should return the money from the Yedaya family to put the money with Yehoyariv to go with the guilt offering, meaning that the one family should take care of both parts. That's according to Rabbi Yehuda. But the rabbis, the majority view, says the opposite, that they should take the guilt offering from the Yehoyariv family and give it to the Yedaya family, who already has the money, the actual cash. And then Yedaya will sacrifice the Asham and make use of the money. So the Gemara wants to know, like, why? Like, what is this dispute that they flip it? Hechidami. Excuse me. B'mishmarto di Yehoyariv, v'chesef li Yedaya, b'mishmarto di Yedaya, ze zacha b'shalo, v'ze zacha b'shalo. The Gemara says, what's going on here? If we say that he gives the guilt offering to the Yehoyariv family and the money to the Yedaya family, each of them during their official priestly watch, like that's where they're supposed to be, in that mishmar, in that watching time of, watching meaning turn, it's right, it's their what's the word I'm looking for? they each have a role in the rotation over the course of the year, right? Really, they serve a couple of times a year. So then the claim here is that each one acquired the thing that's supposed to belong to that family during that time, meaning the Yehoyariv time is that's their jobs, and likewise the Yedaya time. So why then, this is the question, why then would the court need to come ever to take from the Yehoyariv family to give to Yedaya, or Yedaya and give to Yehoyariv? Why wouldn't you just leave it as it fell out that one goes to Yehoyariv family and the other goes to the Yedaya family? So Rava has an answer. I'm a Rava. Hacha b'mayaskina. What are we talking about? The Yayiv Hashem liYehoyariv b'mishmarto diYehoyariv. The Kesef liYedaya b'mishmarto diYehoyariv. So the claim here is that Rava says that the case is that the karban, the sacrifice, was brought to the Yehoyariv family during the Yehoyariv watch, and the money is brought to the Yedaya family during the Yehoyariv watch, meaning it's not the Yedaya family's turn yet. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, Kevan Delav Mishmeret the Yedaya, Lid Yedaya Kansinan Le, Hilkach yachzir kesef etzel Hashem. And so then Rabbi Yehuda's position is basically, it's not Yedaya's turn yet, the family. So we're going to penalize Yedaya, take the money back from the Yedaya family, give it to the Yehoyariv family, and they can have it, right? They can do whatever they want, as they're going to also offer the Korban Hashem, that guilt offering. Rabbanan Savri, what are the rabbinic view? Shelo kedin hu avud b'nei Yehoyariv to keep blue Hashem, makamei kesef. And the rabbis say, well, now what happened here is that the Yehoyariv family should not have accepted the Korban Hashem, the guilt offering, before that money was paid. This came up the other day, right? That the money should be paid first, because he's a thief, he's making restitution. And so the rabbis were there to penalize the Yehoyariv family for accepting the Korban Hashem when they should have been first saying, no, no, you have to pay the money first. And therefore, that penalty means that the guilt offering is going to go to be with the money that they're giving to the Yedaya family on the Yedaya term. Meaning, one of the things that I find very interesting here is that the way Rava explains it, the dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and the rabbis, which looks like they're taking exactly the opposite position. Technically, they are taking the opposite position in terms of each family having to give up the thing that had been given to them. But the rationale for why is really dramatically different. The backstory as to why either the Yehoyariv family or the Yedaya family would have to give it up. And so that I find to be perhaps, you know, the most, it looks like it's all the same, like just mirror image of itself. And the answer is no, really there's more going on beneath the surface, which is why Rava, you know, has to come along to explain this dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. I'm going to stop here, Yordana. There's obviously much more on this daf. It's a long daf, but I'm going to hand it over to you, I think, for the new parak. We're not really finishing off the text here, but we are closing it. In any case, I'll say Hadranach Hagozel Yitzim.
I'm also really struck by, like, how did they decide these were the two families that they were going to use as the example? I can't believe there isn't something deliberate in it. I think we just don't know why. It's bothering me.
So Rashi's answer is just the first two on the list. Is that sufficient? Like, why not pick, you know, number 6 and 7 or 6 and 10? I don't know. I hear your question. I think it's, you know, we want always there to be a very strong reason. And the Gemara is so carefully crafted. I agree with you. It's hard to think that it's kind of just, you know, plunked together.
All right. I'm going to move on to our last parak of Bava Kamma, which is hard to believe. And I guess I'll start plugging our Siyum, which we're going to announce details on soon. And it's going to be in less than 2 weeks' time. So we have a very short Mishnah to kick off this parak. And, you know, in Parak Tet, there was a lot of discussion about circumstances where the robber sort of could acquire the object that they stole and only has to pay a monetary compensation for it. So we're going to continue with that discussion in this parak. And this mishnah is going to start with where somebody steals an object and a third party gets the stolen property. So Hagozel Mathil Epanav. Let's say somebody robs someone and feeds it to his children. V'yaniach livneihem, or let's say he left it to his children as an inheritance. Piturim l'shalem. They do not have to pay the owner for it. Okay. And what we are going to see later on, this is going to be on Daf Kuf Yud Bet on tomorrow's Daf, that it's not just that it applies to the children, but it actually applies to any third party who ate or somehow, you know, the property got destroyed after the property was stolen. And we'll see on Kuf Yud Bet why that is. There's a specific way that they learn it out from the Torah itself. And there's going to be a disagreement about, you know, why that, what circumstances under which this takes place. Okay. And then the second part of this mission says, but if it was real property, then they are liable to pay. Now the question becomes then, what is a davar sheyeshbo achrayut, right? It means something that has responsibility. And this refers to real property, meaning something like land or houses, you know, things like that. So when you steal, right, and you basically have, you know, you now have like a monetary obligation because you need to pay back whatever it is that you stole, right? So a lien would be put on any property that the robber has at that time. Okay. Becomes a question, when does that lien actually take effect? But okay. So this means if the person sells the property, the claimant or the person he stole from can go to the buyer and claim the money that we want, that he wants. So this is why real property has achrayut, right? Because it's always there. So, and that's not like movable property, which is something that could be eaten or could be destroyed or something like that. That's what achrayut is. It's property upon which a lien, something substantive. So it's a land, it's house, a lien could be put on it. And that even with a subsequent sale, right, the buyer could come and would still have to pay the claimant back because of that lien that's there. So the Gemara is going to begin with, so the very terse Mishnah, and the Gemara is going to begin with the following statement of an Amora. Amar Rav Chista, so Rav Chista said, Gazal v'lo nit aishu habalim. So if somebody robbed something and the owner did not have despair yet, and remember, we've discussed this concept of yeish, right? Yeish is the concept that when somebody loses something or they are robbed, right? Yeish is sort of the turning point when we say that this person now knows that they're never going to get this object back anymore. So that's why if you find certain lost objects in, let's say, the Reshut HaRabim or in certain areas, you can sometimes make an assumption of yeish, right? Because, you know, the owner knows that they lost it under a certain set of circumstances. You know, like, I don't know if you've ever lost something on a plane, right? You know you're never getting that back, okay? So that would be the concept of yeish. So if somebody else found it on the plane, they don't necessarily need to return it. Now, that wouldn't be something that maybe has a distinctive mark or the name on it. But in other words, it's just, you know, there's no way that you're going to recover it. So Rav Chis is basically saying, if somebody robbed something and the owner didn't have yeish yet, and then another person comes and ate it while it was still in the property of the robber, right? The person who was robbed has a choice. If he wants, he can collect payment from the robber. Or if he wants, he can, you know, collect payment from the person who ate it. And so the question is, my time, what's the reason, right? Why should the person who ate the item also be chayav? Because the reason is, as long as the owner doesn't have yeish yet, right? The owner still believes he could recover that property. It's in the possession of the owner. So when that person eats the stolen object, right? He basically took it directly from the owner's possession. And so therefore he would actually have to pay it. So what essentially Rav Chista is saying is that this whole ruling of the Mishnah, right, only applies when the person consumed that item after the Baal has the state of Yeyush, okay? But if he doesn't have a state of Yeyush, then of course he would still have to pay. Now the Gemara is going to challenge this by quoting our Mishnah itself and says, Tanan agozo ma'achila banav, if somebody robs and feeds his children, or he leaves it for them as an inheritance, pitzurim milishalein, they are not chayav. And so the question becomes, in this first ruling of the Mishnah, right, to Yutzav de Rav Chista, is actually a refutation of Rav Chista, right? There's no mention here of anything that has to do with Yush, right? It's like, there it just sounds like he stole food, he stole the loaf of bread, right? And he gave it to his children. Like, what, you know, there's no concept. It doesn't mention Yeyush at all. So why is Rav Chista saying Yeyush actually plays into this? So the Gemara says, Amar lech Rav Chista, Rav Chista would say to you, Ki tanyahu, when this ruling was taught, la'achar Yeyush, it had to have been after Yeyush, right? That if, you know, it's logical that that's what it has to be. The Mishnah doesn't actually need to say it explicitly, which is kind of interesting. So here we have Rav Chista come. And the only way Rav Chista can make sense of this Mishnah is to basically put in this whole other concept of yeish, which is totally not the pshat. It's not the, you know, sort of logical, or I would say it's not the clear explanation of the Mishnah, but it kind of does make sense what Rav Chista is saying, but he doesn't really have a textual proof for it, right? He can't bring another brisa. He's just saying it's the only logical way to understand this case, because otherwise, it means like, as long as you give it to your children and have it consumed, they don't need to pay for it. Nobody needs to pay back, which kind of makes no sense.
I think the whole thing of yeish is fascinating, in particular how it changes the status, like without anything else happening.
Yeah, without anything else happening. Exactly. What we're going to see now, I'm not going to read it, but the next part of this is going to explain the case of inheritance, right? And it's going to get into a statement of Rava, which seems to disagree with the Mishnah of Reshut Yoresh Lavka Reshut Lokea, right? The domain of an heir is not like the domain of a purchaser. So it's going to actually sort of, you know, sort of say that maybe the heir actually has different rights than a purchaser actually does. So I think what we're seeing is that we have this Mishnah. It's a very short Mishnah, but the Amoraim are going to have a little bit of trouble. This Mishnah is tricky for the Amoraim to understand.
That's our DOTS discussion for the day. Thank you for joining us. Rate us, review us where you get your podcast. Come talk to us on our Facebook page and tell us what you think of this stuff. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. And until tomorrow, go and learn.